ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय अथ शोचथमायुयम् हरं क्षात्मानमेव वा ख आत्मा ख परो वात्रा स्विया पारक्य एव वा स्वपरापिनिवेशेन विना ज्ञानेन तेहिन After instructing all the foolish relatives of Suyagya, Yamaraj, in the form of a boy, disappeared from their vision. Then the relatives of King Suyagya performed the ritualistic funeral ceremonies. Therefore, none of you should be aggrieved by the loss of the body, whether your own or those of others. Only in ignorance does one make bodily distinctions, thinking, who am I? Who are the others? What is mine? What is for others? Purport. By His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. In this material world, the conception of self-preservation is the first law of nature. According to this conception, one should be interested in his personal safety and should then consider society, friendship, love, nationality, community, and so on, which have all developed because of the bodily conception of life and a lack of knowledge of the spirit soul. This is called ajnana. As long as human society is in darkness and ignorance, men will continue to make huge arrangements in the bodily conception of life. This is described by Prahlad Maharaj as param. In the materialistic conception, modern civilization makes enormous arrangements for huge roads, houses, mills, and factories, and this is man's conception of advancement of civilization. People do not know, however, that at any time they themselves may be kicked out of the scene and forced to accept bodies that have nothing to do with these enormous houses, palaces, roads, and automobiles. Therefore, when Arjuna was thinking in terms of bodily relationships with his kinsmen, Krishna immediately chastised him, saying, Kutastva kashmalam idam vishame samupastitam anarya jushtam. This bodily conception of life is befitting the anaryas, the non-Aryans, who are not advanced in knowledge. An Aryan civilization is a civilization advanced in spiritual knowledge, not merely by stamping oneself an Aryan does one become an Aryan. To keep oneself in the deepest darkness concerning spiritual knowledge and at the same time claim to be an Aryan is a non-Aryan position. In this connection, Srila Madhvacharya quotes as follows from the Brahma Vaivarta Purana. Ka atma ka para iti dehadya pekshaya nahi deha dir atma syan na cha shatru udirata atho daihika vridho va Shaiva kim prayojanam yastu deha gato jiva sahinasham nagacchati tathasatru vividho cha swanase sochanam kuta dehadi vyatirikto tu jiveso pratijanata atta atma vividhistu vasudeve rati stira satru nashastatha jnana nasho nanya katanchana.
The purport is that as long as we are in this human form of body, our duty is to understand the soul within the body. The body is not the self. We are different from the body. And therefore, there is no question of friends, enemies, or responsibilities in terms of bodily conception of life. One should not be very anxious about one's body's changing from childhood to boyhood, from boyhood to old age, and then to apparent annihilation. Rather, one should be very seriously concerned about the soul within the body and how to release the soul from the material clutches. The living entity within the body is never annihilated. Therefore, one should surely know that whatever one has, that whether one has many friends or many enemies, his friends cannot help him, and his enemies cannot do him any harm. One should know that he is the spirit soul, aham brahmasmi, and that the constitutional position of the soul is unaffected by the changes of the body. In all circumstances, everyone, as a spirit soul, must be a devotee of Lord Vishnu and should not be concerned with bodily relationships, whether with friends or with enemies. One should know that neither we ourselves nor our enemies in the bodily conception of life are ever killed. Therefore, none of you should be aggrieved by the loss of the body, whether your own or those of others. Only in ignorance does one make bodily distinctions, thinking, who am I? Who are the others? What is mine? And what is for others?
Today, we are reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 7, Chapter 2, entitled Hiranyakashipu, King of the Demons, Text 59 and 60. Hiranyakashipu is just completing his words of enlightenment to the bereaved family members who are mourning the loss of his brother Hiranyaksha. Hiranyakashipu is a great scholar. He is speaking words which is the very basis and essence of the Vedas with conviction. And the amazing thing is through his preaching, he does alleviate the suffering of his relatives. He described a beautiful story of a king named Suyagya who died in the battlefield. When they were ready to perform the last rites of the funeral, the wives of Suyagya were so attached to that body, they were embracing it. They would not allow anyone to take it away. Weeping, crying, speaking to the dead corpse,
as if they were speaking to their husband when he was alive. It was just too painful. They could not accept that he was dead. Psychologically, it was such an overload that they were embracing him, speaking to him as they would the day before when he was living and breathing. And nobody could pacify them. So Yamaraj, it's his duty, out of compassion. They didn't know that actually what they were doing was harmful to him. Because his soul was so attached to the body, and his soul was so attached to his loved ones, his kingdom, and all the things related to the body, that although the body was dead, the soul was hovering around that body like a ghost. Couldn't give it up. Horrible position. You can't reciprocate with anyone through the body. You can't enjoy the body. You're just miserably seeing it's dead. And you're watching all of your loved ones weeping and crying. You're gone. And you can't speak to them. You can't do anything for anyone, including yourself. But you're so attached, you can't give it up. And that is why, in the Vedic culture, it is tradition. If you die in the daytime, the body is to be burnt before the sun sets. If you die at night, the body is to be burned before the sun rises. Why? The science is to free the soul, to go on to its next destination. It can't do anything anymore. It's just wasting time and unnecessarily suffering in a ghostly way. So Yamaraj appears, but he understood that these women, the queens, they are so aggrieved and attached. They can't hear. That is the nature of the human mind when it is either infatuated due to longing, or lamentation. We were explaining that the nature of the mind is to accept and or to reject. To hanker and or to lament. When we're absorbed, infatuated by hankering, or when we're absorbed and infatuated by lamentation, the mind is so fixed in that way, it's very, very difficult to hear wisdom. Even if you hear it, it just doesn't really enter your heart. There are so many stories like this. There are stories of, in the scriptures, of men who are like Bharat Maharaj. He became infatuated with a deer. And all that he had learned, he knew it was there, the philosophy. But he just forgot about it. He didn't exactly forget, he just put it aside. We have Dhruva Maharaj. He was so hurt by his father siding with his stepmother that even though Narada Muni gave him good instructions, just go home, forgive him, it's not so bad, he said, whatever you're saying may be true, but it doesn't sit in my heart. I'm too pained by what happened.
I can't hear what you're saying.
People who become infatuated by anger, infatuated by lust, infatuated by greed. You could speak to them. What will be the results of your activities? You could speak to them. Is this what you really want? Everything you've gained for so many years, you could just lose it all? But in that infatuated state, very, very difficult to hear. Narada Muni, he was a good preacher. Magrari the hunter. He was half killing animals so that they would suffer a slow, miserable death. Narada Muni saw all these animals just screaming, howling in pain. And he said to Magrari, if you're a hunter, then if you have to do something, then kill them. But why you half kill them? Now, half killing is really an art. Any hunter can kill, but to half kill, it's a science. It's a very fine art. He was very proud. He said, I get great pain when I get great happiness when I see other people suffer because of my powerful controlling nature. This is a very perverted desire for those who want to be God. Krishna is the only enjoyer. He is Purusha. We are Prakriti. We are meant for his enjoyment. Nityo nityanam chetanas chetananam eko bahunam yobadadati kama. Krishna is the one supreme controller, and all living entities, who are plural, are eternally subordinate to the control of God. We want to be the enjoyer, we want to be the controller, and according to the modes we're in the mode of goodness, we want to be the controller. I am feeding the poor. I am building hospitals for the sick. I am enlightening the ignorant. I am educating the illiterate. Yes? That is the mode of goodness. I am the doer, helping others, and I find joy in helping others. That is goodness. Goodness is good. And then there's the mode of passion. I am earning so much money. I am gaining so much fame and recognition within this world. My name will go on in history. I am the enjoyer of owning this and watching this and all of that. That's mode of passion. And mode of ignorance. We want to be the controller. But the joy that we gain by controlling is to see people suffer. Because of my nasty words, I ruin that person's day. Ah, just see my power. I can destroy millions of people with my armies because I don't like them. Stalin, Hitler, what a God complex they had. Whole races of people, whole nations of people. If I want, I can annihilate them all. I am God. They may not say I am God, but they're trying to be God. And what a sense gratification that is to their mind. Just by my word, millions are suffering and killed. The same principle, wanting to be the enjoyer and the controller. And when that mentality is under different modes of nature, it manifests in different ways. Infatuation. And when you're infatuated like that, even somebody tells you, very difficult to listen. Yes, Prabhu, I know what you're saying is true, but my mind just, there's too many other loud voices.
to take seriously the whisper that's coming in your voice.
So in this state, sometimes great souls have to use
creative means.
So Narada Muni tells Murari, he's preaching to him, but Murari can't hear. So Naradaji,
he shows him his future. He gives him a preview into his destiny.
I don't know, I haven't been to movie theaters for, 1969 or something like that. But I don't know how they do it here, but they used to give you, before the main feature film, they give you the previews of what's going to be next week. Yes? This is showing next week. Please come. And you're looking and you just, and they show the best parts. Like, vroom, 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 and you go. And already you put it on your calendar. So previews. Well, Narada Muni gave Murari the Hunter a preview of his karmic destiny. He saw every single animal that he caused to suffer and kill were coming back to him and torturing him. Mercilessly torturing him. And how many of those animals there were. And it worked. He said, all right, you know, I'm ready to come to your class now. And Narada Muni told him, give up your sins, chant Hare Krishna. And he was ready. So similarly, Yamaraj, he sees these women. There's no way that if he just says, I am Yamaraj, I am the Lord of Death, I have some message for you. They would listen, but they wouldn't hear. So they're ladies. And ladies are very sentimentally attracted to little boys or little girls, either one, little children. And especially when they speak philosophy. It's amazing. We could bring this a little child in here, put him on this, and if he could start speaking philosophy, everyone will be spellbound. When I speak, if I spoke the same words, everyone's falling asleep. Just, see? Just look around and see the evidence of my words. The little child comes and starts talking about Hiranyakashipu and Murari the Hunter and Narada Muni, and everyone's like, just see this little boy speak. How can he speak so? How does he know all these things? Beautiful. So Yamaraj came as a little tiny boy and he's speaking profound philosophy about the difference between the body and the soul. And what the results are of being attached too much to the body. And he enlightened the ladies. And they gave up their attachment and they performed they allowed the last rites to be performed and they freed their husband to progress in his karmic destiny. And perhaps because he died on the battlefield, he would go to the heavenly planets. Rather than just hovering around a ghost, watching everybody weeping and crying and doing nothing for them or yourself. So this amazing story is being spoken by Hiranyakashipu. But it's even more amazing than Hiranyakashipu speaking philosophy. He's, even though he knows it and he speaks it, he can't hear it either. And that we're going to see in the future pages of Srimad Bhagavatam. Prahlad Maharaj, his little 5-year-old son, is going to speak practically the same philosophy to the father. Right? But his father can't hear. In fact, he gets so angry at Prahlad that he tries to kill him. And what's Prahlad doing? He's basically saying the same thing that Hiranyakashipu was preaching to others. Hiranyakashipu is not going to such a high level as Prahlad, but basically, you're not this body. Give up. Puna punash charavata charavananam. You're just wasting your life chewing that which has already been chewed. You're not this body. Give up this deep, dark well. Andakupam. And go to Vrindavan and worship Krishna. Hiranyakashipu couldn't hear because of his infatuation, because of his attachments. He couldn't. He's saying to these ladies that, I mean, he's saying to his mother and Hiranyaksha's wives and all his children, saying, don't worry about it. Okay, he's dead. He's not the body. He's the eternal soul. He's talking about friends and enemies and all this stuff. Right? It's here. Why are you so attached? They can't help you. Your enemies can't hurt you. Your friends can't help you. To get this message, Yamaraj appears as a little boy. It appears he's about 5 years old. Now, Prahlad is 5 years old. And he's speaking to Hiranyakashipu. Why can't he hear? He's more an illusion than the ladies that he's condemning. Because he's so attached to his own dead body. And in his school, headed by Sanda and Amarka, they're specifically teaching how to exploit your friends so you can get the most out of them, and how to either subjugate or annihilate your enemies. That is social science. And everything in the school was based around that principle. Maybe they were learning mathematics and histories and all those things, but they were all for that purpose. To teach you how to subjugate and annihilate your enemies if required, and how to defend your friends and exploit them as much as you possibly can for yourself. And if you can't, they become your enemy. Just the exact opposite of what he's preaching. And when Prahlad tells him, I'm not concerned with friends or enemies. I see God in everyone's heart. So everyone is my friend. Hiranyakashipu wanted to kill him. So it's not so difficult to be a good preacher. But it may be very difficult to practice what you preach. What to speak of practice what you preach, to even believe what you preach. Doesn't take much to learn a bunch of slokas. If you could learn mathematical equations, you could learn slokas, right? All it takes is just, you know, applying your brain to it. It's not that much to be able to learn philosophy and speak it, but to believe it and to practice it is only possible when we are blessed by the grace of God. That is not mechanical. Learning, memorizing, speaking could be mechanical. But faith in what you say and the willingness and the capacity to follow what you speak, only possible when a power beyond our own blesses us, which is the grace of God. And in order to access that grace, we have to please the Lord.
samsidhir haritoshana. And in order to please the Lord, we cannot commit offenses to those that the Lord loves. Otherwise, he withdraws that grace. And then, regulative religious principles that we have believed in, we had faith in, and we were practicing very excellently, even for many years. When the Lord withdraws his mercy, we can't do it anymore. We lose our own faith, and we can't follow. It's very difficult. Sometimes that's a lesson that the Lord teaches us for some inconceivable reason, to humble ourselves and to take shelter. Because sometimes when we do good things in religious life, we become proud. Srila Prabhupada tells the story of Punana Mushtaka Bhava. The Lord can make a weak, insignificant, squeaky little mouse that's just afraid of everything and everyone into a roaring tiger who's fearless of anything. Ah. Even the elephants, the tiger just looks at him in the face and says, "Get out of my way." And the elephants will go, Very powerful lions. King of the jungle, not afraid of anything or anyone. So the Lord can make a mouse into a lion, but if the lion becomes proud, again become mouse. So nothing is ours. Prakrite kriyamane niguna karmani sarvasha ahankara. That this ahankar, this false ego, makes us think we're the doer of activities. But it's all the empowerment of God. He can give, he can take. And eventually he takes everything from everyone. So why should we be proud? So Hiranyakashipu, he's a good preacher. But he has no realization. And the Lord takes things away just to give us a chance to become humble and take shelter again. And then he can give us not only everything back, but he'll give us the treasure of realization. So everything is ultimately for the Lord's grace to help us, however it may externally appear. So in these particular verses, Hiranyakashipu is describing how we make such big, big, grand arrangements. But when they're under the pretense of the ignorance that I am this body and those things in relationship to body are mine, they create ultimately nothing but pain. Srila Prabhupada is describing this purport. We can make big, big roads and huge palaces and unbelievable factories, industries. But as long as it's based on this bodily conception of life, can it really bring anyone happiness? Is it really progress in civilization? We work our whole life to do something wonderful, so that we can enjoy the benefits of it, whether it be the money or the facility or the fame or the prestige. But ultimately, things are beyond our control. At any moment, we're going to be kicked out. We see big, big, big people creating huge empires, whether it's in their business or in their politics, whatever, and the next moment, they're gone. Politicians, they work their whole life to get a position. Then they're assassinated. The least expected moment.
big, big business people. They have massive industries, and then they're still just middle-aged people. And some disease or some traumatic event, and they're dead, and everything's gone. It's the nature. Recently, I was in one country, I believe it was Italy, and I was looking at this building, a huge government building. It was magnificent. Oh, just, it was like a blocks long. And it was magnificent marble and pillars, and statues, and it was an architectural wonder. And I was asking, when was this built? Why was it built and who built it? Even I was wondering because it was so amazing, very impressive. And they told me the story. Would you like to hear? This master architect, it was his life's work. It took him, I don't know, 30 years to build it. And he had all the funds of the state and everything else, whether it was the president or prime minister of that country, Italy, I don't remember, but they just gave him huge amounts of funds to build it. And it was supposed to be one of the greatest buildings in modern times, artistically, architecturally, and he did it. He built it. And the world was coming to see it. It was unbelievable. And he was getting all kinds of awards, and he was famous, and he was getting so many gifts and so much prestige, unbelievable prestige. But then what happened? The building started sinking in the ground. And now the world was saying, he spent all that money and the whole building is going to fall down. He was so ashamed. He was so disgraced with himself. He felt it was such a failure that he committed suicide. Hare Krishna. Happiness and distress. The same thing that he gave 30, 40 years of his life to build, his mission, became the very reason of such misery, such unbearable misery. The only way he could deal with it was to commit the sin of suicide. But the amazing thing, after he committed suicide, it stopped sinking. It's still there like 100 years ago. It hasn't sunk, and they found out it's never going to sink. It only sunk like about an inch. So everyone's enjoying it except him. He's probably a ghost just wandering the halls of that building for a long time until the building's disintegrated. He'll probably just be hovering around it as a ghost. An example. How complicated civilization is if you don't realize you're the soul. Just now, a really interesting phenomena has taken place. Just to show how complicated material nature could be. You know, sometimes people, they have babies for money. Yes? Because there's people who are unable to have children. So if you have a child with your husband or with somebody else, I don't know, And then you make it clear that as soon as the child's born, even before the child's born, you sign papers that it's for adoption. And if it's a nice, healthy infant, you can make a lot of money. It's a strange but good business. So this one lady, I'm going to have a baby and I'm going to sell it. She had twins. This is good business. Two for the price of one. No, I mean, the price is double for the effort of one, right? So she has twins, a boy and a girl. And as soon as they're born, she sells them to two different people. And of course, you know, they don't put the name of her or her husband on the birth certificate. They put, you know, the people that they're being sold to. Should I continue? So this little girl grows up in one family in England, and the little boy grows up in another family in England, and they get into their mid-20s, and they're walking down the street, and they're going to parties and everything like that. And then they meet. And for some strange reason, they are irresistibly attracted to each other. For good reasons. And they fall madly in love. And they date each other for some time. And everything is so totally compatible. They just have such compatible natures and such compatible desires and everything else. They get married. Twin brother and sister get married. And then after they're married, you know, they somehow or other found out that actually they were adopted, and they do research after they're married. They both found out that they were both adopted, and they do research. And they find out they have the same mother and father. They're twins, brothers and sisters. We shouldn't be married. This is, what kind of children are we going to have? And everything changed. The romance was finished. So they went for a divorce. And they go to the judge, and annulment. The judge said, you know, you have good case, annulment, no need for divorce and all this. This is pretend you've never been married. Well, this is how complicated material civilization is today. People don't even know who they are. And Bombay, this used to be a nice place. Nice, simple place. When Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came here 500 years ago, he was dancing, he was chanting. There was no traffic. No, what's happening here? I remember a few years ago, they were making those flyovers. Yes? Bridges in some places, but they call them in India flyovers. And everything was just such a mess when they were making those flyovers. The problem is there's too many traffic jams. And then building the flyovers was tripling the traffic jams because everything was construction sites. Do you remember? Massive traffic jam because they're building a flyover. And everyone's just waiting for the day when we can fly over. Terminology is very, you know, psychologically effective. You know, just the word flyover, everyone was thinking, you know, now we're suffering. Yes, yes, the flyover, it's going to take, you know, maybe a year, maybe two, but afterward, we're going to fly over. Well, one man's food is another man's poison. The people who live in the area
who usually don't even own the property. They're just like there. And they're making charges that you are putting too much noise in our area, so we don't want this flyover. So then all the construction has to stop in the middle of this ugly, horrible construction site, which is jamming traffic miserably. And they can't even continue. It's half done. Right? It's a mess. And a stay order. You can't do anything more until... it's in the courts for months and months and months. No, we say you can't build this flyover. You have to just take away everything because it's causing too much noise and it's causing too much this and that, and the government's fighting, and meanwhile everyone else is just honking their horns, and there's nowhere else to go and no other way to get there. And finally, after all that, obviously, the government just pays these people money, whatever it takes, and they continue the flyover while everyone else is just... And then they complete all the flyovers. What, like 20 flyovers or something? All over Bombay. But by the time they complete it, so many people are under the illusion that we just get a car and we'll fly over. So many people buy automobiles, and so many more rickshaws, and so many more trucks, and everything else. By the time the flyovers are done, the traffic jams are exactly the same, if not worse, than they were before the flyovers. Yes? Nobody's flying over. Still. So we went to... This the other day, some of our devotees were coming from Andheri. It took them 2.5 hours to get here. And how many flyovers are between now and here and Andheri? So many. But nobody flies. They should be called crawl-unders. Some people are crawling over, some people are crawling under, but everyone's crawling. That is the problem. But can you imagine if they didn't build these crawl-unders? What a mess it would be. So this is modern civilization. Global warming. All the pollution. All the horrible cancerous diseases from inhaling all of these things. Recently, our godbrother Balavanta Prabhu was here. He's a lawyer. And he was telling one of the clients, there was a place where this big factory, very famous company in America, very, very famous company, a company that's very well known for its providing jobs, doing philanthropy, and part of the whole American economy. Very old company. But the place that they had their factory, the water, the air, everything was so polluted that practically all the children that grew up there have leukemia, blood cancer. Many of them moved to different places, but somehow or other, after years and years, now they're middle-aged people. They all have leukemia. And when they made contact, dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of hundreds of people who grew up there all have the same disease. So they come together, and he's suing the company. Of course, the company has their big, big top lawyers of the nation to defend them. So yes, they made a lot of good products that everyone was using. But what is the cost? Srila Prabhupada was very blunt. You're spending billions of dollars to build bombs in the name of defense. But what are you going to do with those bombs? When people have weapons, there's a tendency to use them. And there are so many mad, crazy people in this world. During the Cold War, where America's enemy was Russia and Russia's enemy was America, United States, they were both building arsenals of nuclear bombs, competing with each other. I mean, why? I mean, if you logically try to make sense of it, it's really crazy. America shows a bomb, then they have to build a bomb, then they have to build a better bomb, and then they have to build a better, and they're just escalation, escalation, escalation. They have dozens and dozens, hundreds of nuclear bombs, both of them. What are they going to do with them? Why? If you drop on me, then I'll drop on you. And before you drop on me, if I know you're going to drop it on me, I'm going to drop it on you. But then you're going to drop it on me, and then I'm going to drop another one on you, and then everybody's going to be dropping. India, Pakistan. It's small time compared to what was going on between America and Russia. But still, America tests a bomb. India tests a bomb. Pakistan. India has a carrier of missiles for the bombs, and Pakistan has to get a better one and better and better and better and better. And it's just, and these weapons are just all over the place. Srila Prabhupada says they're spending billions and billions and billions of dollars to make these weapons, and ultimately it's just very likely just to create mass misery and destruction for everyone, including the people who make them, and all their family members, and all their descendants, and everybody else. Under the illusion of Maya. Srila Prabhupada says, when people commit so many sins, Maya dupes these people to make these massive, massive technologies that's going to just bring back their karma. And they think, I'm the doer. But they're not the doers. They're done. It's just material energy, using them as ignorant puppets to be the instruments of suffering to others. And we call this advancement of civilization. Yes, we have our cellular phones. But God knows what the result is going to be. We talk. Srinathji Prabhu, he's an electrical engineer. He has a cell phone and he always holds it like this with a speaker. If you ever talk to him, he's like, rah, 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 rah. How do you know? And he told me, he says, according to my analysis, putting a cell phone to your ear is like sticking your head in a microwave oven. Now, he's a PhD in electrical engineering. I am only repeating his words. But even if it's true, who's going to stop using it? It's so convenient. How could I live without it? Anywhere you go. I remember I called my father once. I thought he was home. I heard this noise. I said, what's that? He said, I'm on the golf course in a toilet. It was in a golf course, in a toilet, in the 12th hole of some golf course. He was in a toilet. And I called, and he answered the phone. And while he's talking, he's flushing it. So what's that? And I thought you were home. It used to be you'd call someone's home number. You know they're home, right? Now you call someone and the first question you ask, where are you? Are you in Bombay? No, I'm in Australia. I thought I was calling just to tell you I'm coming over to bring you some prasad, but I guess I can't afford to come to Australia. So complicated. Yeah, we told the story about that study of the bees. The bees are pollinating so many fruits and pollinating so many vegetables. It's nature's will. Pollination. The bees drink some nectar and they get the pollen on their mustaches or whatever they have. Not like Indian people's mustaches, but the bees' mustaches. And then they go to the next flower and the pollen falls off and it pollinates. And for there are many vegetables and fruits and things like that, it's the only way they can grow is the bees pollinate them. And now these cell phones, you know, bees have those little antennas that come out. And they can relate to each other and relate to the atmosphere on the basis of those little antennas. And now there's all these cellular phone frequencies all over the place, and they're affecting the bees. They're becoming neurotic, psychotic. The bees are becoming bewildered. They're becoming bewildered. And why are the bees bewildered? Because human society is bewildered. SMS and all that other stuff. Now, so many conveniences, but what it's going to do to the world. We don't really know. Simple living, high thinking. God has created nature in such a perfect way. One devotee scientist was telling me about the sun. The sun is the source of heat and fire. The sun, just think of the sun. It's fire. The planet of the sun is fire, yes? And the sun rays that are emanating from the sun, these sun rays are traveling millions of miles, and they don't go out, right? Like we make a fire and the spark, how far does it go? It gets less and less and less. The sun comes, and the sun rays, which are like little beams of fire almost, they don't, it's not like all the rays are going like sparks hitting our body. It feels nice. It might be warm sometimes, but in the winter it just feels so nice. And the sun rays are going into trees and creating the wood. And what is the wood? The wood is stored with the fire of the sun. Yes? And that's why when you Prabhupada says wood is actually fire. The energy of the sun is stored within it. But it can only be released when it comes in contact with fire directly. Then what its inherent nature is just released and the fire comes out. Now in some places, you know, eventually the trees die, yes? And they fall to the ground and they go into the earth. And this devotee scientist was telling me, goes into the ground, and after hundreds and thousands, if not millions of years, it's transformed into coal. Now millions of years has passed.
And that tree, the wood, is totally transformed now into coal. But still, now it's way, way underground. But still, the power of the sun, the fire power of the sun is still in it. And you light coal, and what happens? Fire. And then when coal is unused for hundreds and thousands, if not millions of years, what does it transform into? Oil. And we drill the oil. And what is the quality of oil? The power of the sun. The energy of the sun is still in it. Now the amazing thing, whether it's wood or coal or oil, the sun is so powerful. That energy is existing within for millions and millions of years. The rays are hitting us, but it's just way underground where there's no sun at all. But still, the sun's energy is so powerful there. But there's no way to release that energy unless we put it in contact directly with fire. It's just dormant. In other words, it has to associate with fire to revive its innate constitutional nature. This is the law of nature. Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Sajya Kabunoi Sravanadi Sudicheti Kodiye Yudhoi. Inherently, we are all part of Krishna. Inherently, we all love Krishna. It is our nature. Love of God is dormant within everyone. But somehow or other, we're all like pieces of coal. It's dormant within us, but there's no manifestation of it. Because we're just associating with darkness. So we're just in darkness. Mahatsevam dwara mahurava moktes tamo dwaram yoshita shangi shangam. But when you associate with people who love God, it's like putting fire on oil. The inherent fire nature of oil manifests. And it could heat the buildings, and it can make your cow run, it could do so many things. But oil in and of itself is useless. It's disgusting. Yes. But when you bring out its inherent quality, so many things can be done with it, so many useful things. So in the same way, the only way to awaken and manifest the inherent love of God, the inherent blissfulness of the soul, is association, to come in contact with people who love God and to come in contact with God. Association is so important. And that is why there is no more powerful means of delivering the soul than chanting the holy names. Nam nama karibau nijasarva shaktish. The holy name is none different than God, all the power of God. Through the various processes of yoga, karma, there's the karma kanda where we try to elevate ourselves by relieving us of ourselves of our sins by performing pious activities and nice yajnas to please higher powers. Then there's the astanga kanda where through breath control, through moral principles, through yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, dharana, dhyana, pratyahara, samadhi, these eightfold yoga systems are meant to gradually, you know, align your lifestyle with nature, God's nature. But the most powerful direct means, Harinama, Harinama, Harinama Eva Kevalam, is the chanting of God's name, because the name is none different than God. The name of God puts you in direct contact with the Supreme Lord, Bhagavan. Therefore, it's the most powerful, most direct means. And what happens when you come in that contact?
Nitya Siddha Krishna Prema Satya Kabunai.
That inner perfection that's dormant within your heart awakens in that association directly. Two most powerful principles Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taught: associating with devotees and chanting the names of the Lord and hearing the glories of the Lord. That fire of love of God is within us, but it's completely dormant and forgotten. But by coming in contact with those who love God and chanting the holy names, it's like lighting fire. And it just blazes and burns to ashes all of our misconceptions, all of our ignorance, all of our worldly attachments. And that fire illuminates our hearts and illuminates the world. So Prabhupada said, chant Hare Krishna and your life will be sublime. When Srila Prabhupada first met Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur in 1922, first meeting, Prabhupada just never met this sadhu before, just bows down, didn't even want to go to see him. He was forced to go to see him by one of his friends. Prabhupada said, amongst my friends, you will be happy to know I was always the leader. And they wouldn't go to see Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur unless I approved. And they really liked him, so they wanted my stamp of approval. So they dragged me there. And I bowed down to this Swami. And he said, oh, you are an intelligent, educated young man. You should take the teachings of Lord Chaitanya and spread it in the English language in the Western world. Prabhupada was just that year. He dedicated his life to Mahatma Gandhi's movement, Swaraj. Gandhi encouraged, quit college. Renounce your college, renounce your degrees, and renounce your careers based on those degrees. That's a big step. How many of people are willing to do that? We're not talking about brahmacharis. We're talking about married people. Prabhupada was married with a child. He quit. That was his dedication. So he said to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur Prabhupada, that, who is going to listen to our message when we are a subjugated nation? First, we must obtain our independence and give dignity and integrity to our nation, then people will hear what our philosophy and culture may be. And Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur said, no. We are eternally the spirit soul. We are part of God. That is forever. There will be so many political changes, and but the truth must be spoken now. And then he said, people must understand that their real benefit is not who rules the nation. Their real benefit is not what their profit, and economic successes may be. The real benefit must be taught how to prepare for your next life. That was his words. If we understand we're the spirit soul and we understand that we could die at any moment because there's danger at every step, padam padam yadvi padam natesham, and it's inevitable, we should live in such a way that we spiritually prosper and find real happiness in this life, and when this temporary lifetime is finished, we are prepared
to go back home, back to Godhead. That is real benefit. That is advancement in civilization. Actual advancement in civilization is to the degree that people are preparing for their next life in this life. There can be prosperity, and there can be beautiful things, and there could be so much others, but it's always in connection to what purifies our heart and brings us closer to God. Hiranyakashipu is teaching very nice this lesson, but at least his son understood nicely. Actually, Narada Muni taught his son. Yes? When the son was in the womb, Narada Muni was preaching to the mother. And little Prahlad in the embryo heard his teachings. Now, Narada Muni was not a stranger to Hiranyakashipu. It explains Narada Muni used to visit Hiranyakashipu. And Narada Muni would offer his obeisances, his pranams to Hiranyakashipu. But Hiranyakashipu couldn't hear a word he said. We all have our free will. And that is the lesson of today's verse. Is there any questions? Yes, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna Maharaj.
Harivo.
Maharaj, we are living this, as you said, modern civilization. And like that, is there a hope to change to go Vedic civilization?
Huh?
Is there any hope like that it will change the civilization like that? Again, just so much
is modern there civilization. Hope, yes, that the civilization will change?
Back to the Vedic civilization.
Back to the Vedic civilization.
And what is supposed to do devotees who are staying modern life?
Harivo. Well, in Satya Yuga, it will definitely be nice Vedic civilization. But that's a long time away. So there's hope. It is our duty to do whatever we can to help. And because the course of human behavior is self-destructive, anybody who's really thoughtful about today's status of how the world is existing with its passion for development knows that it cannot continue. The sun shining so nicely. Why not live in the light rather than just going deeper and deeper and deeper down into the darkness to find oil? Right? And the amazing thing is, the longer you do it, the deeper you have to go. Yes? As far as I was told, I'm a layman and something like a sadhu. What do I know about these things? But people tell me things. One of the greatest oil powers of the world in the last century, beginning time, was the United States. They were drilling oil in Oklahoma and Texas. They were getting a lot. They were exporting it. They were powerful because they had such a supply. But the nature is, the more you dig, it starts getting, you have to go deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper. Just like if you have a well, you take from, if there's no, let us say, a bin of water, a dry well, you fill it with water. And you, at the beginning, it's so easy. You just like, but then you can't reach anymore.
And you have to get a rope and go. And pretty soon you're like. When it's way down, you're going. Well, that's the way it is. And it costs a lot of money to go down, down, down. The more you take it, the more it goes deeper, 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 deeper. And the deeper it is, the deeper you have to pay for it. So the Middle East, pretty soon, it's going to go deep, 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 deep. It's going to cost a fortune everywhere. It's an unrealistic civilization. How are they going to survive? They're increasing, 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 increasing the artificial needs for it. But in due course of time, you know, it may go up, 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 but then it's go down, 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 down. It's going to cost a fortune to get any of it, and it's going to cripple the whole society. It is inevitable. And not only is it going to cripple because the supply is going to be so difficult to get and it's going to become so rare and expensive, but also in using it, it's disturbing the whole ecology of our planet. All of this global warming and other such problems, it's creating pollution. Cancer due to the ultraviolet rays of the sun, infrared rays of the sun, and all these things are coming, and beyond what, because the filter of the atmosphere is no longer working properly. So disease is happening to individuals. The ice caps are melting. The oceans are rising. Bombay may someday be just a bay. Unless it's bombed. Very difficult. So the Vedic philosophy is so relevant. If we can teach people how to find their satisfaction, their happiness, and their peace within themselves, within their relationship with God. They don't have to just be like mad people just blindly exploiting the very resources that sustains their life, polluting their own consciousness. So yes, there is great hope. We're distributing these wonderful books of Bhagavad Gita. We're trying to exemplify the life that is taught by Bhagavad Gita. We're trying to spread the glories of the holy name, to awaken that love, that compassionate nature within people. And if we're effective and we're convinced, we could be empowered. Srila Prabhupada used to say, I'm one 70-year-old Indian that came to the West with God's message. Look at what one person has done. Tens and thousands of people's lives, hundreds and thousands of people's lives have been transformed. Prabhupada expected each and every one of us, if we just become really sincere, we can be empowered by that same energy that Prabhupada was. If one person could do so much, how much could 100,000 people with that same power do? To enlighten people, to live in harmony with their own souls and with God. And as things become more and more impossible and difficult, which is inevitable, in the Bible it is said, if you build a house on a foundation of sand, it's going to fall. The civilization we have now is built on a foundation of sand. It's actually not sustainable. Now, we're not just environmentalists and ecologists. We are that too, but
That's unsustainable too for the soul. The real foundation is knowledge. That I am not this body, I'm the eternal soul. And this body is meant to be utilized as according to the will and the needs of the soul and in harmony with God. Yukta Vairagya, we could use science, we could use technology, we could use so many facilities within this creation, but it should be used in harmony with the will of God. We don't have to neglect, but we have to have proper motivations. And it has to be directed with knowledge of actually what's beneficial. And we could make a big difference, definitely. And when things start really crushing, we have answers. We have a foundation built on a stone of knowledge that we can present to people. Does that answer your question? Very well. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.